Do you want me to beg Langfala?
Now it was Monday morning, September 11th, 1944. Under glowing sun and azure sky, with the tart fragrance of early autumn in the air, the president's train arrived at Wolf's Cove Station in Quebec. Roosevelt was carried to an open black phaeton, where he sat waiting for Churchill. When the prime minister's train arrived, Churchill emerged wearing a blue uniform, naval cap, vest, and gold watch chain. He was swinging a cane and smoking a large cigar. He walked to Roosevelt's car and shook hands with the grinning president. The crowd cheered. Roosevelt and Churchill lunched at the towering old citadel. The old building had been built to defend the city after the failed U.S. attempt at conquest in the War of 1812. On Tuesday morning at the citadel, Roosevelt woke up in his large bedchamber. He was given a "My Dear Friend" message from Churchill. Churchill wrote, "It is painfully apparent that one of the most important things I have to discuss with you is future American lend-lease aid to England. Would Thursday the 14th do for that? In that case, I hope you could have Morgenthau present." On Tuesday evening in Dutchess County, New York, a Secret Service agent handed the Treasury Secretary a telegram from the president. It said, "Please be in Quebec by Thursday, the 14th of September, noon. Roosevelt." Morgenthau was delighted. He boarded a military plane for Quebec. On Wednesday morning, September 13, a rainstorm drenched Quebec. Inside the citadel, Roosevelt and Churchill met with their combined chiefs of staff. Churchill said that historians would give a great account of the 10 months since the Tehran meeting. "Since D-Day," he said, "everything we have touched has turned to gold." He said he was proud that the British Empire could claim equal partnership with the United States, the greatest military power in the world. Roosevelt reminded him that Stalin deserved no little of the credit. Especially in Stalin's absence, Roosevelt wanted the conference record not to show anything that might look like an Anglo-American conspiracy against the Soviets. Roosevelt was anxious that Stalin keep his promise to fight the Japanese after the defeat of Germany. Roosevelt now told Churchill that it was still not quite possible to forecast the date of the end of the war with Germany. Hitler's armies were retreating from the Balkans and Italy, but he said the Germans have always been good at staging withdrawals. The Anglo-Americans might have to fight one more big battle. Raising the subject of post-war Germany, Roosevelt noted that there were certain groups in both of their countries who have a kindly attitude toward the Germans. He said that such people presume that evil could be eradicated from the German makeup and that Germany could be rejuvenated by kindness. Churchill replied, "Such sentiments would hardly be tolerated in Great Britain." He said the British people would demand a strong policy against the Germans. The German working man should be allowed sufficient food for his bare needs and work, but no more. He said the more virulent elements, such as the Gestapo and the young fanatics, should be deported to work in rehabilitating the devastated areas of Europe. Churchill had spent his adult life dealing with the tides of German power. In 1911, while Germans were expanding their navy and deepening the Kiel Canal to let German battleships rush to the North Sea, Churchill was first Lord of the Admiralty. His job was to prepare Britain for war. No Englishman was more eager for victory than Churchill in World War I, but when the war was over, as Minister of Munitions, Churchill warned his colleagues that they might have to build up the German army and get Germany on her legs again to stop Bolshevism. "Kill the Bolshe," he told his friend Violet Asquith. "Kiss the Hun." In the 1920s, Churchill had vainly pressed to relax the Versailles Treaty's harsh sanctions against Germany. Better, he said, to show mercy toward a weakened Germany now than later have to fight the nation when it was emboldened by desire for revenge. In 1936, Hitler broke the treaties of Versailles and Locarno and seized the Rhineland. Churchill felt sadly vindicated. The Soviets joined Great Britain against Hitler in 1941. As Churchill put it, he wooed Joe Stalin as a man might woo a maid. By radio, Churchill assured the British people that the cause of any Russian fighting for his hearth and home is the cause of free men and free peoples in every quarter of the globe. But in private, Churchill worried about a post-war Europe dominated by Stalin. He said, "I do not want to be left alone in Europe with the bear." In 1943, Churchill told Foreign Secretary Eden, "We mustn't weaken Germany too much. We may need her against Russia." By the summer of 1944, Churchill was unsettled by the speed of the Red Army's march through Eastern Europe and the Balkans. On Wednesday afternoon at 4 o'clock, Henry Morgenthau arrived at the President's grand suite at the Citadel. He had been invited for tea with the Roosevelts. The President turned to his dog, Fala. He said, "Say hello to your Uncle Henry." Roosevelt told Morgenthau that Churchill had brought along his close advisor, Lord Cheryl, whom Churchill called by his nickname, the Prof. Morgenthau asked how freely he might talk with the Prof. Roosevelt said, "You can talk about anything you want." Thinking of his plan for Germany, Morgenthau asked, "Anything?" Roosevelt said, "I wouldn't discuss with him the question of the zones to be occupied by our armies in Germany. That's a military question. Nor would I discuss the question of partitioning, as that's a political question. But you can talk about the fact that we are thinking of internationalizing the Ruhr and the Saar, including the Kiel Canal." As the Treasury Secretary departed, Roosevelt handed his copy of the Morgenthau Plan to his secretary, Grace Tully. He said, "Put that book right next to my bed. I want to read it tonight." That evening, Churchill took Morgenthau's presence at dinner as a sign that Germany must be foremost on Roosevelt's mind. As they dined, Churchill asked Roosevelt, "Why don't we discuss Germany now?" At the President's invitation, Morgenthau described his plan, showing how closing down the Ruhr would bolster the British steel industry and help stave off post-war British bankruptcy. When he heard that, Churchill was indignant. He said to Roosevelt, "Is this what you asked me to come all the way here to discuss?" He denounced Morgenthau's proposals with anger. He said he would not chain himself to a dead German. He said, "I'm all for disarming Germany, but we ought not prevent her living decently. Germans must not be allowed to starve. You cannot indict a whole nation." Churchill said, "The British people will never stand for such measures. They are unnatural, unchristian, and unnecessary." He added that seizing Germany's old steel business would bring England little economic relief. He felt that a starving and bankrupt Germany would not be in the British interest. Morgenthau later recorded, "I have never had such a verbal lashing in my life." He wondered whether Roosevelt had deliberately let Churchill wear himself out attacking me. During the dinner, Morgenthau reminded Churchill of his lamentation in London that Britain would be destitute after the war. Roosevelt reminded Churchill that it was Stalin at Tehran who had demanded the German industry be destroyed. It was clear that Churchill was worried that Roosevelt would use the Morgenthau Plan as an excuse to reduce future American aid to Britain. Because if crushing German industry gave Britain new exports, why should Churchill need so much American cash? As they left the room, Morgenthau warned Roosevelt that the Russians seemed to be holding back from full cooperation out of fear that we and the British would make a soft peace with Germany and build her up as a future counterweight against Russia. Roosevelt said, "You're right, and I want you to read a telegram I just received from Harriman." Averell Harriman, the American ambassador in Moscow, had cabled that the Soviets had lately started trying to force us and the British to accept all Soviet policies backed by the strength and prestige of the Red Army. He said that unless this were stopped, the Soviet Union will become a world bully wherever their interests are involved. After his verbal laceration by Churchill, Morgenthau did not sleep that night. On Thursday morning, September 14, Lord Cheryl came to his rooms at the turreted Hotel Chateau Frontenac. To support himself, Morgenthau had Harry Dexter White close at hand. Churchill's biographer Martin Gilbert called Cheryl the Prime Minister's closest friend and confidant. Arch, unmarried, partial to Rolls Royces and country weekends, the Prof was known as Churchill's one-man brain trust. After dinner on Wednesday night in Quebec, Cheryl had reminded Churchill that Morgenthau's plan would save Britain from bankruptcy by eliminating Germany as a dangerous competitor. Cheryl had insisted that somebody must suffer for the war, and it shouldn't be Britain. He later recalled, Winston had not thought of it that way, and he said no more about the cruel threat to the German people. Starting the bargaining on Thursday morning, Cheryl told Morgenthau that Churchill wanted to know how much lend-lease aid the United States had in mind before Britain made any commitments on Germany. Morgenthau said he imagined granting Britain $6 billion in post-war credits. Leafing through a copy of the Morgenthau plan, Cheryl said he couldn't understand why Churchill had been so contrary the previous evening. Then, at 11:30 a.m., Morgenthau and Cheryl joined Roosevelt and Churchill at the Citadel. Roosevelt told Churchill that they should have their people work out terms for future lend-lease aid to Britain. Not surprisingly, Churchill suggested that Harry Hopkins should be chairman of the negotiating team. He knew that Hopkins was a great friend of Britain. Roosevelt refused. He appointed instead the more tough-minded Morgenthau. Cheryl told the group that he hadn't had the time to study all of the Morgenthau plan, but he was definitely attracted by the possibilities. Now, to Morgenthau's astonishment, Churchill reversed himself from the previous evening. Churchill said, "There's a good deal to be said for this approach. The Allies are entitled to make sure Germany cannot commit wanton acts of aggression." Roosevelt said he did not consider it an undue hardship to turn Germany back into the agricultural nation she had been before the late 19th century. Abruptly, Churchill pronounced himself converted. That afternoon, Roosevelt and Churchill were about to initial a memo authorizing lend-lease negotiations, but the president changed the subject and began telling stories. Churchill, who knew Roosevelt so well, feared that the president was scheming to postpone or even avoid signing the document he was so desperate for. Finally, Churchill burst out, "What do you want me to do? Get on my hind legs and beg like Fowler?" On Friday, September 15, at noon, Roosevelt signed a document pledging the United States in principle to more lend-lease aid. With tears in his eyes, Churchill said they were doing this for both of their countries. At Churchill's behest, Cheryl and Morgenthau drafted an Anglo-American statement on Germany. When Churchill read it, he said, "This isn't what I want." He called in his secretary and dictated his own memorandum. When Churchill spoke of crushing industry, Roosevelt insisted that he insert the phrase, "in Germany," not just the Ruhr. The President and Prime Minister now solemnly read the endorsement by Churchill of Germany's conversion into, quote, "a country primarily agricultural and pastoral in its character," end quote. On the 226-word memorandum, Roosevelt scrawled, "OK, FDR." Churchill wrote his initials in the date. Churchill's language did not include the destruction of all German mines and factories. But as Morgenthau wrote in his diary, he was terrifically happy that he had achieved just what we started out to get, and that Churchill had dictated this himself. Why had Roosevelt pressed Churchill to agree to that memorandum on Germany? At that moment, various German anti-Hitler plotters were pressing both Stalin and the West to make a separate peace. Roosevelt wanted to ensure that the Soviets stayed in the European war until the Germans surrendered unconditionally. Another reason was this. Roosevelt was worried that his own officials would combine with Churchill and the British Foreign Office against him. He was worried that they might undercut his determination to avoid the mistakes of the First World War and try to build a new democratic Germany from the ground up. Another factor was that the president, of course, knew that the Quebec document was not binding. He knew that the real decisions on Germany would be made later by him, Stalin, and Churchill. But even if the Quebec document were later weakened, he knew that it would be a bulwark against the soft-on-Germany crowd in Washington and London. The Quebec Memorandum on Germany also indulged Roosevelt's habit of using his sentimental feelings in his diplomacy. Like Morgenthau, Roosevelt believed that Jeffersonian democracy was best nurtured on the farms and countryside. Roosevelt fantasized that Germany could actually be turned into a nation primarily of yeoman farmers close to their own land. Throughout their wartime alliance, Churchill was always the weakest member of the Big Three, and he knew it. At crucial moments in his diplomacy, Churchill performed surprising flip-flops, trying to maximize British power even if it cost him consistency. He certainly felt that signing the Quebec document was Roosevelt's price for more American lend-lease aid. On Friday afternoon, Roosevelt and Churchill discussed German occupation zones. The president had used three colored pencils to sketch out German zones on a map of Europe. As long planned, the Soviets would be granted the northeastern zone of Germany. But as Roosevelt had told Churchill in February, he was absolutely unwilling to be saddled with the landlocked southwestern zone. He felt that the owner of that zone would have to police adjacent France and deal with a possible post-war French Revolution. He had told Churchill, "France is your baby." Instead, he said, the United States should have the northwestern zone with access to the North and Baltic Seas. Stimson felt that for Roosevelt to be so hell-bent on the northeastern zone was ridiculous. He told the president not to worry about France. He said there couldn't be any revolution until at least the war was over. By then, American troops would be out of France. If the United States took the southwestern zone, it would be further away from the dirty work that the Russians might be doing with the Prussians in eastern Germany. Reassured by his Secretary of War, Roosevelt did not argue too fiercely with Churchill. The Prime Minister promised to ensure him sea access if Britain got the northwestern zone. Roosevelt agreed. After dinner on Friday night, while Churchill met with his aides, Roosevelt and Mrs. Churchill screened the just-released 20th Century Fox picture Wilson, starring Alexander Knox. As Roosevelt watched the scenes of the 28th president collapsing from a stroke while fighting for his post-war League of Nations, he cried, "By God, that's not going to happen to me." After the meeting at Quebec, the Churchills went to Hyde Park to be house guests of the Roosevelts. There, the president and Churchill initialed another memo on the secret atomic bomb program, which the two men referred to by its code name, tube alloys. The memo said that when the atomic bomb was ready, it might perhaps, after mature consideration, be used against the Japanese. By the time the Churchills left Hyde Park, Roosevelt was exhausted. He told his adoring Hudson Valley friend, Margaret Sukley, that he had had a good conference with Churchill, but now he wanted to sleep all the time.
A hell of a hubbub.
Back at the Treasury, Henry Morgenthau told his aides that Quebec was the high spot of my whole career in the government. He said that Roosevelt had told him that he had been groping for something, and we came along and gave him just what he wanted. That weekend, John McCloy called Henry Stimson on Long Island. He told the Secretary of War that at Quebec, Roosevelt had ruled flatly against us. Stimson was furious. He wrote in his diary, "Apparently the President has gone over completely to the Morgenthau proposition and has gotten Churchill and Lord Cheryl with him. The cloud of it has hung over me pretty heavily over the weekend," he wrote. "It is a terrible thing for such a critical matter to be decided by Roosevelt and Churchill," he wrote, "both of whom are similar in their impulsiveness and their lack of systematic study." Stimson complained that there had been no one to advise the two leaders at Quebec except yes men. Stimson wrote that everyone he had spoken to was horrified by Morgenthau's Carthaginian attitude. "It is Semitism gone wild for vengeance. If ultimately carried out, and I cannot believe that it will be, it as sure as fate will lay the seeds for another war in the next generation." Stimson told his diary he would send a written protest to Roosevelt. He wrote, "It will undoubtedly irritate the president. He dislikes opposition when he has made up his mind." At the start of his appeal to Roosevelt, Stimson wrote of the far-sighted and greatly humanitarian president. He reminded Roosevelt that the Atlantic Charter that he and Churchill had signed in 1941 promised that victors and vanquished alike are entitled to freedom from economic want. He said they must not reduce 70 million Germans to a peasant level. In Washington, McCloy was recruiting allies to fight Morgenthau. He said that Morgenthau's linkage of post-war Germany to lend-lease aid couldn't be more sordid. McCloy warned Secretary of the Navy James Forrestal that over Stimson's violent disagreement, Morgenthau was battling for the conscious destruction of Germany's economy and a state of impoverishment and disorder. McCloy had lunch with Harold Ickes, the Secretary of the Interior. Ickes said, Morgenthau ought not have anything to do with this matter of Germany for the simple reason that he is a Jew. The charge will be made that through him, the Jews are dictating peace terms that no one in the end will be willing to accept. Ickes wrote in his own diary, such a plan as Morgenthau proposes is the worst possible. Much as I hate the Germans and mistrust them, I do not believe that a vindictive peace would mean anything but another war, even if the Germans had to fight with their hands. On Wednesday morning, September 20, at the State Department, Morgenthau reported on the Quebec Conference to Hull, Stimson, and McCloy. The news from Quebec had left Hull sleepless and depressed. Suffering from a bad cold, he had not been able to understand how Roosevelt could behave, he said, with such irresponsibility and deviousness. He privately thought that the Morgenthau plan was mad. As Stimson later wrote in his diary, Morgenthau spoke modestly and without rubbing it in, but it was the narration of a pretty heavy defeat for everything that we had fought for. During the meeting, Morgenthau asked Stimson whether he knew Cheryl. Stimson replied, very well. But, he said, he did not know whether the prof meant the professor or the prophet. All he recalled about Cheryl were his false prophecies that the cross-channel invasion would fail and that Hitler's robot bombs would never do any harm to London. Hull said bitterly that since he was being excluded from such vital matters as post-war Germany, he was rapidly losing interest in his job. Morgenthau left the meeting outraged by Stimson's opposition. He warned the president by letter that Stimson's approach to post-war Germany was appeasement. A downhearted Stimson dined at Woodley with Frankfurter. The Supreme Court justice assured him that the Roosevelt-Churchill agreement on Germany would evaporate because the British people wouldn't stand for it. Stimson felt better. He later wrote that he had found Frankfurter so cheerful and optimistic that the justice cheered up the evening of a gloomy day. The next morning, Thursday, September 21, was Stimson's 77th birthday. Knowing that Stimson was disgruntled about Quebec, Roosevelt sent him a bouquet of roses. The birthday was shadowed, however, by a Drew Pearson column in that morning's Washington Post. The column was almost certainly leaked by one of Morgenthau's men, perhaps Harry Dexter White, who was close to Pearson. The Quebec conference was not mentioned, but Pearson reported that people at the State and War Departments had been quaking in their boots after Roosevelt blew up over their failures on occupation plans for Germany. According to the column, Morgenthau, in disgust, had tossed the Handbook on Military Government on the desk of the president. In a letter to Stimson, an angry Roosevelt had denounced passages in the handbook that were especially weak or stupid, and ordered that Germans be fed nothing more than 3 bowls of soup a day. McCloy was furious. He told Stimson that Pearson had practically quoted word for word the spanking letter the president sent you. He said there was every indication that the column came from the Treasury. At noon, by telephone, McCloy gave the New York Times columnist Arthur Kroc discreetly chosen details about the Cabinet Committee on Germany and Morgenthau's presence at Quebec. Kroc's column the next morning was entitled, Why Secretary Morgenthau Went to Quebec. Kroc did not reveal the Morgenthau plan or the Roosevelt-Churchill memorandum, but he reported that Morgenthau had become Roosevelt's central advisor on post-war Germany. At the White House on Friday, September 22, Secretary of the Interior Harold Ickes lunched with Roosevelt and his daughter Anna under the Andrew Jackson Magnolia. Ickes felt the president was decidedly showing the wear and tear of the past 11.5 years. He mentioned a rumor that Morgenthau intended to give campaign speeches for Roosevelt across the country. He told the president how intense the feeling of anti-Semitism is and how disliked Morgenthau is. Roosevelt said he understood, but that Morgenthau was simply planning his next war bond drive. Ickes warned that the Pearson story about soup for the Germans would be very bad politically. Roosevelt disagreed. He said there might be a situation where the army would have to set up soup kitchens. He said the soup would be ample and nourishing. Roosevelt wondered aloud how Pearson got so much information. Like Ickes, Roosevelt's daughter Anna also resented Morgenthau's backdoor influence. She strongly felt that as a Jew, Morgenthau should have nothing to do with post-war Germany. She also feared that German propagandists could use Morgenthau's role to stiffen resistance among the Germans by claiming that the Jews would run Germany after an Allied victory. After listening to Ickes complain about Morgenthau, Anna told him, "It was almost as if you had taken the words out of my mouth." Roosevelt, who knew his daughter's feelings well, later joked that she must have told Ickes what to say. The next morning, the Wall Street Journal on page 1 revealed the Morgenthau plan to the world for the first time. The headline said, "Treasury plan calls for dismemberment, ban on most heavy industry." The story, by Alfred Flynn, called the plan Carthaginian. This was the same term that Stimson and McCloy were using in private. This suggests that the article might have been leaked by the War Department. The next morning, Sunday, September 24, John Hightower of the Associated Press added another piece to the puzzle. He revealed that Morgenthau had presented his plan at Quebec and left with the impression that Churchill found it acceptable. He reported that the Morgenthau plan had split the cabinet wide open, with Hull unhappy about it and Stimson violently opposed. Now Morgenthau knew he was in big trouble. It was just 6 weeks before a close presidential election, and Roosevelt was determined to present a united front during wartime. But now Americans had been told that his cabinet was at war over the Morgenthau plan. Morgenthau's only comfort now was that no one yet had discovered the signed agreement between Roosevelt and Churchill at Quebec. At 9:45 a.m., Morgenthau called the president at Hyde Park. The president refused to take his call. To stem the damage of the news stories, Morgenthau asked Roosevelt's secretary, Grace Tully, to suggest that Press Secretary Stephen Early prepare a statement. The statement would say that cabinet members had given certain private advice on Germany and would naturally abide by any decision the president made. 6 agonizing hours later, Morgenthau heard back from Tully. She told him that the president didn't want to do anything about it. This made Morgenthau even more upset. By Wednesday morning, September 27, Roosevelt was back at the White House. He called Henry Stimson to ask who was responsible for making the Morgenthau plan public. Stimson blamed Morgenthau. He noted that Drew Pearson's column had violently criticized both Hull and me and played up Morgenthau. Having read Stimson's protest letter about the Morgenthau plan, Roosevelt now distanced himself from what he had done in Quebec. He told Stimson he didn't really intend to make Germany a purely agricultural country. He said his underlying motive was very confidential. The motive was, England was broke. Roosevelt said, something must be done to give her more business to pull out of the Depression after the war. Stimson was relieved. He told his diary that he felt that Roosevelt now realized that he had made a false step and was trying to work his way out of it. On Thursday, September 28, General George Marshall had lunch with Morgenthau at the Treasury. He warned Morgenthau that publicity about the Morgenthau plan was increasing German resistance. He said, "We've got loudspeakers on the German lines telling the Germans to surrender, and this doesn't help one bit." Morgenthau told Marshall, "The Germans were almost successful in the First World War, even more successful in the Second, and might win in the Third. You as a soldier know that as soon as this is over, the German General Staff will immediately plan another war." Marshall disagreed. He said, "You will find that the American soldier doesn't want the German treated harshly." Marshall recalled that after World War I, despite the strict orders of General Pershing, American soldiers would go in the back door and sit down with German families and enjoy themselves. He said that one of his own worst headaches since entering Germany had been photographs of American troops fraternizing with the Germans. Later, McCloy complained to Morgenthau about the fracas over his plan. He said, "There has been a hell of a hubbub and a very deplorable one." Morgenthau replied, "And I'm the one who's had to take it on the chin." During the press frenzy over the Morgenthau plan, Joseph Goebbels was working overtime to exploit it. A German newspaper brayed, "Roosevelt and Churchill agree to Jewish murder plan." German radio announced that Roosevelt's bosom friend, Henry Morgenthau, spokesman of World Judaism, was singing the same tune as the Jews in the Kremlin, "Dismember Germany, destroy its industry, and exterminate 43 million Germans." The Washington Post complained that the Morgenthau plan was senseless. It said it would implant a festering sore at the heart of Europe, leaving a chaos which would assuredly end in war. It said, "If Germans suspect that nothing but complete destruction lies ahead, then they will fight on. Let's stop helping Dr. Goebbels." A naval officer wrote to the Post in reply. He wrote that twice in my lifetime, I had to halt the bestial bloodletting of the Huns. In the name of God and decency, of little children brutally starved and slain, helpless women burned into Gestapo furnaces, isn't it time we stopped it once and for all? Leaders of the anti-Semitic American right proclaimed that the Morgenthau plan confirmed their direst alarms. One was Father Charles Coughlin, the once popular Roman Catholic radio priest. Coughlin had railed against the Jews through the 1930s before his church had ordered him silenced. Now Coughlin privately grumbled that Morgenthau wanted to emasculate the German men. He later insisted that Morgenthau's sterilization plans didn't get out in public but got to me. Coughlin claimed that a disgusted Roosevelt had criticized Morgenthau, saying, "You SOB, how inhuman can you become?" In fact, Coughlin would have been startled to discover that the private jokes in Washington about castrating the Germans had been made not by Morgenthau, but by the President and Ickes. On Friday morning, September 29, Arthur Kroc wrote once again in the New York Times. This time he reported that Roosevelt was about to perform an about-face on the Morgenthau plan. He said that high administration sources were passing out word that Roosevelt does not favor the plan and never really did. Kroc noted that Goebbels was making obvious use of the plan, asking why Germans should not die to the last man to resist such an Allied conquest. With his two sons on active duty, Morgenthau was tortured by Kroc's charge that his plan was increasing German resistance. He told his aides, "Am I going to sit in the cabinet knowing that the American people and the soldiers are being sold down the river on the entrance to Germany?" Harry Dexter White told him, "I think you have to take whatever rap is coming during the next month. The president will do whatever he thinks is of interest to him politically. After the election, it'll be a different story." Morgenthau's press aide, Herbert Gaston, speculated that Hull and Stimson had changed Roosevelt's mind about the Morgenthau plan. He said, "Even an agreement at Quebec isn't finally binding. They're working here and abroad to upset it." Morgenthau replied that Roosevelt had shown him no sign that he had reversed himself one iota. Unbeknownst to Morgenthau, Cordell Hull spoke that morning in profound confidence to Kroc about Morgenthau's mad German plan, as he called it. He confided that he hadn't realized that Morgenthau would be in Quebec until he read about it in the newspapers. He could not understand why Roosevelt had allowed Morgenthau to do such damage. Hull went on to say he often talked the president out of some folly, but Roosevelt always kept someone between them. Hull said he was sick and tired. He said that after the November election, whatever happened, he would quit his job. The public furor over his plan was giving Morgenthau fierce migraine headaches. He finally seized a humiliating last resort. He walked to the White House, took the elevator upstairs, and camped out beside the closed door of the president's office in the family quarters. The president's daughter Anna was acting as her father's guard. Morgenthau gave Anna a sheaf of positive clippings on his plan for Germany. He asked her to make sure her father saw Kroc's column. Anna gruffly replied, "Oh, the president knows all about that." Morgenthau said, "Please take it in and show it to him. I think he ought to get Hull, Stimson, and me together in the same room and read the law to all of us and tell us to stop talking." Anna disappeared into her father's office. A few minutes later, she returned. Despite Morgenthau's efforts to resist, she pushed him onto the elevator, saying, "All I know is the president said he definitely doesn't want to see you." That day, Roosevelt was asked by the press about the reported split in the cabinet. He said that every story has been essentially untrue. I might emphasize the word essentially. Roosevelt added that he would ask Leo Crowley, now at the Foreign Economic Administration, to advise him on German post-war exports and trade. This was a clear suggestion that he was turning against the Morgenthau plan. If German industry was to be destroyed, why would he be thinking about post-war German trade? At the same time, Roosevelt abolished his month-old Cabinet Committee on Germany. To mollify Hull, he privately asked him to study and report to him. He wrote Hull, "No one wants to make Germany a wholly agricultural nation again, and yet somebody down the line has handed this out to the press. I wish we could catch and chastise him." The other cabinet member left to be mollified was Stimson. On Tuesday, October 3, the war secretary came to the White House for a long conciliatory lunch with the president and his daughter Anna. In preparation, Stimson had scribbled notes to himself on Germany. He scrawled, "Objective of punishment is prevention but not vengeance. Reason why Jew is disqualified." Over the lunch, Stimson plunged a dagger into Morgenthau. He told Roosevelt that if Morgenthau had seen fit to discuss the handbook directly with him and McCloy, corrections could have easily been made and there would have been no hubbub. As Stimson later noted, Roosevelt grinned and looked naughty. Shirking all responsibility, the president cried, "Henry Morgenthau pulled a boner." Stimson continued the conversation. He told Roosevelt that throughout the war his leadership had been on a high moral plane. He mustn't poison it now with hatred or vengeance. He said he had shuddered when Morgenthau launched his campaign against Germany. He said Morgenthau must have known how a man of his race would be misrepresented for so doing. Roosevelt and Anna emphatically agreed. The president lamented the unfortunate publicity. He said he had no desire to turn Germany into an agrarian state. He said he merely wished to save some of the Ruhr's proceeds for Britain, which was broke. Stimson wagged his finger. He reminded the president of the memo he had initialed at Quebec. Roosevelt said, "About this pastoral agricultural Germany, that is just nonsense. I have not approved of anything like that. I am sure I have not." Stimson was shocked. He said, "Mr. President, please don't say that abroad until you have refreshed your memory with this paper, which I have here in my pocket." Stimson pulled out his copy of the Roosevelt-Churchill memorandum with the initials OKFDR. As Stimson later recalled, the president was not a man to get flustered, but the Quebec document left him perfectly staggered. Roosevelt told Stimson he had no idea how he could have endorsed such language. Whether affected by his deepening illness or sheer deceitfulness, the president told Stimson, "Henry, I have not the faintest recollection of this at all."
As useful as 10 fresh German divisions.
On Thursday, October 5, 1944, Harry Dexter White went to the unproletarian Marble Beaux-Arts Soviet Embassy on 16th Street in Washington. Over vodkas, the Soviet ambassador, Andrei Gromyko, asked White where he stood on Germany. White replied sardonically that all Gromyko had to do was read the Washington Post. He said, "Where does Russia stand?" Gromyko replied, "I don't know anything official, but I would think that they stand very close or closer to what is spoken of as the Morgenthau Plan." Morgenthau could not have imagined, but Gromyko certainly knew, that Harry Dexter White had a close, secret relationship with Soviet intelligence. White was born in 1892 in Boston to Russian-Jewish immigrants. He added the English-sounding Dexter while in high school. When the United States declared war against Germany in 1917, he immediately enlisted in the army and fought in France. At the age of 30, by then married to Anne Terry, he enrolled in college, studying economics at Columbia and Stanford, and then taught for 5 years at Harvard. Unable to win tenure, White took a job in 1932 at Lawrence College in Wisconsin. White's Treasury colleague, Edward Bernstein, later recalled, "I think Harry was exposed to all sorts of prejudice as a Jew. It was very hard to get a professorship in Harry's day if you were a Jew." In 1934, White jumped at the chance to return east and work at the Treasury. After Pearl Harbor, Morgenthau told his aides that White would be in charge of foreign affairs for me. He said, "I wanted all in one brain, and I wanted in Harry White's brain." White was blunt, sardonic, hardworking, and rapaciously ambitious. With blue eyes darting from side to side, he strode down the Treasury halls. Stocky and mustached, White became Morgenthau's director of monetary research and chief source of intellectual capital. White's flow of praise appealed to a Treasury secretary who was insecure about his own abilities. In Dale Carnegie fashion, White concentrated his charm on the boss's chief assistant, Henrietta Klotz. By 1944, White was closer to Morgenthau than ever. Along with the British economist John Maynard Keynes, he was an architect of the post-war world economic order, an order that would be centered around an international monetary fund and World Bank. According to newly opened evidence, however, White was also secretly meeting with Soviet intelligence agents. In August 1948, after he was accused by the famous American communist defectors Elizabeth Bentley and Whitaker Chambers, White told the House of Representatives, "I am not now and never have been a communist." 5 days later, he died of a heart attack. In 1953, President Dwight Eisenhower's Attorney General, Herbert Brownell, announced that his review of the evidence showed that White had been a Russian spy. He said that White had smuggled secret documents to Russian agents for transmission to Moscow. By 1953, Morgenthau was retired from public life. He agonized over charges that his close aide had abused his trust. He wondered whether White had duped him into making decisions that benefited the Soviet Union. With horror, Morgenthau wondered whether White had somehow manipulated him to launch what became the Morgenthau Plan, handing him the offending document on the plane to Europe, badgering Eisenhower, Wynant, and Eden about post-war Germany, compiling the thick black book that Morgenthau handed to Roosevelt, and finally stealing Morgenthau for battle in Quebec with Churchill. Had White maneuvered Morgenthau on behalf of the Soviets to help keep Germany from blocking their domination of post-war Europe? Despite the recent release of new documents, we may never know whether White was chiefly moved by his own philosophy, by Soviet bribes or other pressure, by a higher allegiance to the Soviet Union, or an arrogant certainty that he knew best how to handle America's trusted Soviet ally. The hidden motivation of so opaque an operator as White is difficult to prove. But one thing is for certain. Had White's Soviet connections been revealed to the public in the fall of 1944, there would have been a scandal. That scandal could have undermined Roosevelt, Morgenthau, and the effort to win both the war and the peace. It might well have put Roosevelt's opponent, Thomas Dewey, in the White House. In the wake of such a scandal, any American effort to be tough on Germany might have had a fatal pro-Soviet taint. But Roosevelt and Morgenthau knew nothing about White's secret life with the Russians. In the fall of 1944, Morgenthau asked the president to elevate White to Assistant Secretary of the Treasury. Roosevelt said that he thought that White had earned it. He said that he thought the new title would help White, since so much of his work is with foreign governments. Churchill worried about the fact that Stalin had not come to Quebec, so he flew to see Stalin in Moscow in October 1944. Playing to his audience, Churchill told Stalin that for about a month or so in public, he had been shy about breathing fire and slaughter in Germany because it might make the Germans fight harder. But he said that in private, he was all for hard terms. He said the best thing would be to beat the Germans into unconditional surrender and then tell them what to do. Stalin agreed. He said if they didn't use hard measures, Germany would start a new world war every 25 or 30 years. Thus, the harshest measures could prove the most humane. He said Germany must be partitioned, its heavy industry destroyed. Foreign Minister Molotov asked Churchill what he thought of the Morgenthau Plan. Churchill said Roosevelt was not very happy about its reception. He added that the British people would never allow the mass execution of Germans, but it was necessary to kill as many as possible in the field. He said after the war, the Hitler Youth must be taught that it is more difficult to build than to destroy. Stalin said that to do the job correctly, the Allies would have to occupy Germany for many years. Churchill said the Americans were not likely to stay in Europe very long. In another conversation, Churchill told Stalin that he wanted to put the Ruhr and Tsar permanently out of action. He said that after the war, Russia and other of Hitler's victims could take as many German machines as they needed. This was the policy of Morgenthau, he said, whose hatred of the Germans was indescribable. As for Britain, he said, it was only justice for his country to get Germany's old markets. Stalin agreed to support any steps Britain took to be compensated for the losses it has suffered. Churchill said that the German metals, chemical, electrical, and other industries that made war should be closed for at least a generation. He said that Prussia, the military taproot of the German arch-evil, should be amputated from Germany. He said that the industrial region along the Rhine should go under international control. Stalin agreed. Churchill marveled that they had so few differences. He said it was a pity that when God created the world, he had not consulted the two of them. Stalin liked the joke. He said it was God's first mistake. Back in Washington, Morgenthau was suffering under the whip of public criticism. Roosevelt sent him a report from his intelligence chief, William Donovan, saying that a majority of pre-war Europe's farm machinery had been produced by Germany. The tacit message was, shutting down German industry might force all Europeans to starve. Morgenthau was unfazed. He wrote back to Roosevelt, "I would like to say, in the words of your son Johnny, so what?" As Morgenthau wrote in his diary, that same month, Stimson handed him an olive branch, which I accepted with pleasure. He approved Stimson's request to make a deposit in a secret account, the purpose of which will not be known to anyone in the Treasury or elsewhere. The secret purpose was development of an atomic bomb. The fall of 1944 wore on. Predictions of a quick German surrender were evaporating. Only on October 22, after Germans fought with desperate brutality, did U.S. troops raise the Stars and Stripes over Aachen, their first major conquest on German soil. Morgenthau had tried his hand at the proclamation by General Eisenhower to be posted in English and German as U.S. troops scrambled across the border. Morgenthau's version was to begin, "We come as militant victors to ensure that Germany shall never again drench the world with blood. The German people must never again become the carriers of death, horror, and wanton destruction to civilization." McCloy didn't like it. He told Morgenthau, "I don't like the death and destruction and drenching with blood business myself." He said that the language was a bit lurid and out of keeping with Eisenhower's approach. McCloy prevailed. In the end, Eisenhower's Proclamation No. 1 to the people of Germany began this way. Eisenhower said, "The Allied forces serving under my command have now entered Germany. We come as conquerors, but not as oppressors. In the area of Germany occupied by the forces under my command, we shall obliterate Nazism and German militarism." In October 1944, Stimson wrote in his diary that Roosevelt's campaign against Thomas Dewey was getting hot and uncertain. On Wednesday, October 18, for the first time, Dewey used the Morgenthau Plan as a campaign weapon. In a New York speech broadcast on radio, Dewey recalled that when Roosevelt went to Quebec, he took not his Secretary of State or War, but Morgenthau. He said that Morgenthau's qualifications as an expert on military and international affairs are still a closely guarded military secret. And what was the result, he said? A first-class cabinet crisis. Dewey complained that Joseph Goebbels had used the Morgenthau plan to terrify the Germans into fanatical resistance. He said, "Now the Germans are fighting with the frenzy of despair." Morgenthau was terrified that publicity about the Morgenthau plan might provoke the Germans to capture and be extremely cruel to his son Henry III. He asked his friend and private lawyer Edward Greenbaum whether Henry might be given a false identity and dog tags. McCloy told Greenbaum that the Germans were constantly equipping their spies with false identification. If the Germans caught Henry with counterfeit dog tags, the U.S. Army would have to completely disown him. Greenbaum advised Morgenthau instead to ask Eisenhower's aide, Walter Bedell Smith, to have his headquarters pull Henry out of his outfit and send him to a quiet sector. Morgenthau refused. He said, "Henry would never forgive me. I do not want to have the boy touched." At the White House, Roosevelt was being taunted about the Morgenthau plan by both foe and friend. In the Oval Office on Thursday morning, October 26, Joseph Kennedy asked Roosevelt why he had let Morgenthau go to Quebec. He said it was sheer madness, the meddling of a proved incompetent. Kennedy disliked Morgenthau. One reason was because Morgenthau had the one job in the Roosevelt administration that Kennedy had wanted for himself. With effrontery that the president seldom encountered, Kennedy told Roosevelt that he could not abide the crowd around you, people like Sam Rosenman and Harry Hopkins. He said they have surrounded you with Jews and communists and alienated the Catholics. He warned, "They will write you down in history if you don't get rid of them as incompetent, and they will open the way for the communist line." Kennedy left the White House to have lunch with Arthur Kroc of the New York Times. He told Kroc that Roosevelt looked sick and never should have sought re-election. He said that now he understood how Morgenthau had pushed through his plan for Germany. Kennedy told Kroc that in November, he would be voting for Dewey. Later, Kennedy wrote his 19-year-old son Robert about Morgenthau's plan. He wrote, "I don't think anybody really had an idea of what the plan was because it was never fully explained. Of course, it was never Morgenthau's plan. He wouldn't know enough to have a plan. It was conceived by a Jew named Bernstein from the Treasury." 4 days before the election, on Friday, November 3, Arthur Kroc had a new story in the New York Times. He reported that Roosevelt and Morgenthau had bribed Churchill to accept the Morgenthau plan by promising generous lend-lease aid. Morgenthau read the Times at his Dutchess County farm. He was apoplectic. The next day, a reporter friend warned Morgenthau that Dewey was about to skin him alive. In his final campaign speech at Madison Square Garden in New York City, Dewey was going to speak on the Morgenthau plan and how it prolonged the war. In his oration, Dewey said that the Morgenthau plan was so clumsy that Mr. Roosevelt himself finally dropped it, but the damage was done. He said that the plan had been for Hitler as useful as 10 fresh German divisions. Dewey said that the blood of our fighting men was being shed for Roosevelt's improvised meddling. Roosevelt had wound up past campaigns with a sentimental journey up the Hudson River, with Morgenthau riding beside him in an open car. They had started the tradition around New York State during the gubernatorial campaign of 1928. Despite the fracas over the Morgenthau plan, on the day before the November election, the Treasury Secretary was once again in his customary position in the left-hand back seat. But this year was wartime, and he and Roosevelt were surrounded by bulletproof glass. On election night, 1944, Morgenthau and his wife Eleanor took their usual place among Roosevelt aides, relatives, and neighbors to receive the election returns in the president's big house. While guests waited in the long, dark-paneled library, Roosevelt sat with various aides in his mother's old dining room computing returns. At 3:16 a.m., as Roosevelt's aide William Hassett recorded, The graceless Dewey gave a concession speech but sent no message to the victor. Just before retiring for the night, Roosevelt told Hassett, "I still think Dewey is a son of a bitch." Hassett replied, "Back to his grandparents on both sides." Roosevelt had been re-elected by 432 to 99 electoral votes, but his popular margin was the narrowest since Woodrow Wilson's in 1916. Back in Washington, Harold Ickes told Roosevelt's daughter Anna that thanks to Dewey's campaign charges, Morgenthau had become a pretty heavy load to carry. Ickes said that anti-Semitism is on the increase. He said, "The less Henry has to do with the German settlement, the better." But that was not what Morgenthau had in mind. He was planning to take his case to the American public. He planned to publish a book on the Morgenthau Plan to be released on the day after Germany collapsed.
Lord, give the President strength.
With his fourth-term victory in place, Roosevelt retrieved his old Hudson Valley companion from the outer darkness. On Wednesday, November 15, 1944, the President had Morgenthau to lunch upstairs at the White House. The old West Virginia Senator Harley Kilgore had just issued a report demanding the German industry be so altered that it cannot again serve the purposes of war. While lunching with Morgenthau, Roosevelt called Kilgore's report wonderful. Morgenthau felt that Roosevelt no longer cared what the public thinks, and that his coolness toward his plan for Germany was just lifting like a cloud. Roosevelt told Morgenthau that he had asked Hull and his deputy, Edward Stettinius, for their recommendations about Germany. Morgenthau should read them and tell the president what he thought of them. At that moment, although the public was told he was suffering from a cold, Cordell Hull was being treated for advanced tuberculosis and diabetes in a VIP suite at Bethesda Naval Hospital. To avoid harming Roosevelt's re-election chances, he had deferred his resignation announcement until after the balloting. In late November, Roosevelt announced that Hull's successor would be Stettinius. Stettinius was a former Morgan partner and U.S. Steel president. With his snowy mane and theatrically groomed eyebrows, Stettinius could have been Hollywood's idea of a Secretary of State. Since Stettinius was mainly a show captain, Roosevelt could remain his own Secretary of State, which was exactly what he wanted. The president hoped that Stettinius had the clout with Republicans and big business that would persuade them to support his cherished dream of a post-war United Nations organization. Morgenthau was disappointed. He noted that Stettinius was a lifelong Republican and that Roosevelt had clearly wanted a good clerk at State. Harold Ickes wrote in his diary that the Stettinius appointment had driven him to depression. He wrote, "The new Secretary of State was a backslapper. He likes everyone and is liked by everyone." Stettinius warned Morgenthau that his new memo to the president on Germany might not go far enough to satisfy you. He said, "And if it doesn't, why, we ought to thrash it out." Morgenthau agreed to thrash it out with you before appealing to Roosevelt. He told Stettinius, "Is that fair enough?" Stettinius agreed. McCloy warned Stimson that now that the election was over, Morgenthau was back in business on Germany. When Morgenthau and John Paley of the War Refugee Board made a public statement against new German atrocities, Stimson told Morgenthau that he should have been consulted in advance. Morgenthau apologized, but Stimson wrote in his diary, "It's just an example of how Morgenthau likes to push into that kind of matter. He, as a Jew, is the last man who ought to do it." Stimson and McCloy had been working on a directive for Eisenhower. The directive was to be called JCS 1067. 1067 had much of the sound of the Morgenthau Plan. It would tell Eisenhower to exert such control over German industry, farms, and other facilities as necessary to stop war production, starvation, and sabotage, but Eisenhower was not to rehabilitate the German economy. 1067 said that Germans must be made to understand that all necessary steps will be taken to guarantee against a third attempt by them to conquer the world. This was tough language, but McCloy had quietly inserted important loopholes. One was this. The U.S. commander in Germany could impose such economic controls as he may deem essential to the safety and health of the occupying forces. This loophole meant that there would be no large-scale immediate destruction of mines and factories in Germany. 1067 also gave wide authority to the U.S. commander, who would be overseen by Stimson, McCloy, and the Pentagon. On war crimes, 1067 softened the American position. It said nothing about summary executions and gave the commander considerable latitude. Morgenthau had been arguing for months that the American governor in Germany should be a civilian. But Stimson and McCloy persuaded Roosevelt that the commander should come from the War Department, preferably the Army. Morgenthau was so grateful for 1067's militant language that he chose to ignore how McCloy had weakened the directive. On Monday, December 11, Roosevelt got a cable from his intelligence chief, William Donovan. Donovan's cable included a warning from Alan Dulles, his man in Bern. Dulles warned that the Morgenthau plan, by showing that the enemy planned the enslavement of Germany, was welding ordinary Germans to the Hitler regime. Dulles warned that the Germans were continuing to fight because they were convinced that defeat would bring only oppression and exploitation. 5 days later, Hitler launched a mighty counteroffensive, soon known as the Battle of the Bulge. 3 days after the surprise battle began, McCloy sent John Bodiger to see Morgenthau. Bodiger was the president's son-in-law. He was married to Anna Roosevelt. He had just returned from Aachen, the first significant German city under U.S. occupation. Hitler had hoped that Aachen would be his Stalingrad. He had ordered the SS and police to evacuate Aachen citizens at gunpoint if necessary and defend the city to the death. But a German colonel had defied Hitler and surrendered more than 3,000 remaining citizens in Aachen, most in hiding. McCloy hoped that Bodiger's first-hand description of the hazards in Aachen might make Morgenthau relax his strict demands of U.S. occupying troops. Bodiger reminded Morgenthau that American troops in Aachen had had to fight for 5 weeks against heavy German resistance. He said the troops had complained to him that the Morgenthau plan was worth 30 divisions to the Germans. Morgenthau anxiously wondered whether Bodiger was speaking on behalf of his father-in-law. Morgenthau later told his aides, "When you go up against a fellow like that, you can't forget that he eats one or two meals a day with the president." He told his staff, "It is getting lonesomer and lonesomer." He told his sons, "Nobody is starving in Aachen, and the responsibility for what they get to eat and how they live is entirely up to the Germans. And if it doesn't work, it is their fault and not ours." Roosevelt had once hoped that by the end of 1944, the war against Germany would be over. When victory came, he and Eleanor planned to make an immediate journey to see U.S. troops on the battlefront. Then they would celebrate with the Churchills in London. But now, with the Battle of the Bulge, that dream seemed distant. Stimson wrote in his diary that the pressure of the great battle lies on everyone, and I would not be human if I didn't feel it. Stimson wrote that they now faced a somber future, with heavy casualties and hard fighting through a long, cold winter. At Sunday noon, December 31, 1944, Stimson went to the president's White House bedroom. He told Roosevelt that the Germans had massacred dozens of American prisoners at Malmedy, Belgium. The president replied, "Well, it will only serve to make our troops feel toward the Germans as they have already learned to feel about the Japs." Roosevelt told Stimson about the meeting with Stalin and Churchill planned for January. The top secret site would be Yalta, the old Russian spa on the Crimean coast. Stimson said to the president, "Yalta seems like a very long distance from home." Clearly ailing, Roosevelt replied, "Stalin gave as the reason that his own doctor had forbidden him to travel far." Just after New Year's 1945, the isolationist Senator Burton Wheeler of Montana demanded that with the Battle of the Bulge raging, Roosevelt should drop his brutal and costly insistence on unconditional surrender. Wheeler said that the majority of Americans are unwilling to sanction a peace of vengeance against Germany. Nor did they want America to police Europe, a seething furnace of fratricide, civil war, murder, disease, and starvation. But in the European war, the tide was turning. Morgenthau exulted by letter to his sons overseas that the U.S. Army was beating back the Germans. Soon after New Year's, Stettinius invited Morgenthau to a very sumptuous luncheon, as he called it, at Blair House. Morgenthau wrote his sons overseas, "I do think that from now on we'll get better cooperation." But then Morgenthau discovered that Stettinius and McCloy were excluding him from meetings and correspondence on post-war Germany. Morgenthau planned to complain to the president after cabinet on Thursday, January 11, but he changed his mind when he saw how very tired Roosevelt looked. Instead, he sent a memo to be included in the president's weekend reading at Hyde Park. In his memo, Morgenthau wrote that the real motive of most who oppose a weak Germany is fear of Russia and communism. If we don't face it, I am just as sure as I can be that we are going to let a lot of hollow and hypocritical propaganda lead us into recreating a strong Germany and making a foe of Russia. He said, "I shudder for the sake of our children to think of what will follow." On Friday, January 19, Roosevelt met with his cabinet. He joked, "The first 12 years are the hardest." He told them that his trip to see Stalin and Churchill would take 4 or 5 weeks. For security reasons, he did not tell them the site. The next day at noon, Roosevelt was sworn in without overcoat for his fourth term on the White House South Portico. The inauguration was held at the White House, not the Capitol, in deference to a nation at war. Standing in the crowd on the snow-dusted lawn, McCloy wrote in his diary, "The president looked distinguished, determined, and solemn. He spoke briefly. It was not a great speech, but a good one." The next day, Morgenthau wrote his sons, "Tonight we are going to the White House to celebrate the president's birthday." Hinting that Roosevelt was leaving for a Big Three meeting, he wrote, "You know his birthday isn't until the 30th, so you can put two and two together, and I hope it doesn't make five." Late that night, after celebrating his 63rd birthday, along with 13 grandchildren and sundry daughters-in-law in town for the inauguration, Roosevelt, his daughter Anna, and the rest of his party slipped out of the White House and boarded his train bound for Norfolk. There the cruiser Quincy was waiting to take him across the Atlantic. Back at the White House, Roosevelt's aide William Hassett told his diary that few had been told where the president would meet Joe and Winnie, and he wrote, "I am not among that limited number." He went on that having achieved every political ambition a human being can aspire to, Roosevelt now had to think of his place in history. Hassett wrote, "So FDR will win his niche or pass into the oblivion which in a quarter of a century has swallowed all the statesmen of the First World War. Who am I to ponder the imponderable? Lord, give the president strength, courage, and heavenly wisdom."